Indiana 92-65. In the NHL, the Blackhawks topped the Flames 4-1. Now, the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Scattered light rain showers today and tonight. Today's high 58 and overnight low of 48. South winds at 5 to 15. For tomorrow, rain, a slight chance of thunderstorms. Windy to boot, a high of 55. Then looking ahead, another rainy and mild day on Wednesday, then dry and sharply colder for Thursday and Friday, with highs for both of those days sticking in the 40s. Right now, mostly cloudy skies, at least in Kenosha, temperature reading of 51 degrees, winds out of the south at 9 miles an hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Gregory Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be learning something about the history of that rigid rectangular grid which encompasses most of Manhattan, the heart of New York City, one of the greatest cities in the world. Where did that grid come from and how has it shaped the development of that city? By the way, tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be looking back 100 years to the Turkish genocide of Armenian Christians. A special event commemorating that tragedy is going to be happening a week from tomorrow. And this Wednesday, we'll be talking with a children's author about her book about children and the symphony. And we'll talk with Alvaro Garcia from the University of Wisconsin Parkside about their upcoming concert, which will feature music from Star Wars. That is coming up on Wednesday's morning show here on WGTD. Any of you who love the city of New York City, have visited there as I have, or are fascinated by it, I think are going to really appreciate an incredibly fascinating new book called City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. Any of you who have ever visited Manhattan have experienced the grid that is the heart of Manhattan. But it's one of those realities that is so easy to take for granted. One sort of assumes that it was always there, and it was sort of inevitably there. But in fact, the grid that marks, by and large, all of Greater Manhattan is in fact a very careful construction, a very careful design with an array of purposes in mind. And up until now, nobody has ever stopped to talk about that grid in the kind of detailed fashion that Gerard Coppell does in his new book called City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. He looks at the history of this great city and what it was like before this grid was conceived and constructed, and the way in which the city in subsequent decades has taken shape, and the way in which this grid in many respects shapes life there for the people who live and work in New York City and for all of us who visit there on a regular basis. And what kind of influence has this grid had on the construction of other great cities around the world? All of these issues and more are examined in this exciting and interesting new book. I had the pleasure of speaking with Gerard Coppell on a previous occasion when we talked about his book called Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal in the American Empire. That was a very similar experience for me in that I had certainly heard of the Erie Canal, but I knew next to nothing about it, and certainly knew nothing about its significance, at least at the point in time in which it was constructed in the early 19th century. This grid for New York City was conceived in roughly the same time frame, and so we are stepping back into a very similar chapter of our own country's history. The book, by the way, is published by Da Capo Press. Gerard Coppell, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, good morning.
I am very, very excited to talk with you. I want to share with our listeners that I got a text with you just a few minutes before we began this interview saying that you were, the sense I got was you were rushing to your office in order to get there. You want to make sure I wasn't already trying to call. But it's funny, I had this very vivid picture of you either sitting in a cab or rushing down the sidewalk in the city that we're talking about today. Is that kind of the scenario this morning for you?
So I had an appointment this morning at 1st Avenue and 14th Street. My office is at Broadway and 11th Street. And I quickly had to think as I came out of that first appointment, okay, what's the quickest way to get to where I need to go? You know, 14th to 11th, 1st Avenue to Broadway, which in this part of town is just west of 4th Avenue. So I cab walk, and you know what I finally decided was it was best to walk. And so I mapped out my route, you know, thinking in my head, okay, I'll walk across 14th Street. When the light change, you know, I'll walk west on 14th, light changes, I'll drop down a block, light changes, I can't cross traffic, I'll go across another block. And basically I made a zigzag pattern from where I had been to my office. And that is what you do when you're in Manhattan. you pretty much walk on straight lines and make right-hand or 90-degree turns.
Hmm. You write at one point in your book, though the shortest distance between two points is not around a right angle, New Yorkers must navigate thousands. Perhaps this is what makes New Yorkers run, rushing from loss towards gain. So in a sense, you lived out one of the realities that you enjoy exploring in this book. You lived it out this morning, as you do, I suppose, just about every morning you're in Manhattan.
Pretty much happens every day, happens to millions of people every day. You know, I mentioned that my office is on 11th Street just off Broadway. You know, Broadway, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is the only street in the bulk of Manhattan that actually moves at a diagonal. And it was not in the original grid plan of 1811. Broadway started way downtown at the southern tip of Manhattan and proceeded up the island as it turned into what was called Bloomingdale Road, essentially a country road going up the west side of the island. Well, the commissioners who came up with the grid plan in 1811 figured that Broadway should basically just stop at 14th Street and just discontinue it above that, essentially shutting down the hundreds of years old Bloomingdale Road, because Broadway moving at a diagonal to the west kind of interfered with their rectilinear ideas.
Hmm. You have a interesting and passionate relationship with the city of New York City, and that is also a relationship which, if anything, means more to you now than maybe it once did. Just say a word about that, because I think it's an important overview for us to have before we begin exploring the specifics of this book.
I'm sorry, Greg. What were you asking?
About your relationship with the city itself, with New York City. In a sense, your feelings for it, because I want to lead then into what prompted you to craft
sure.
this book.
Well, you know, I was born on the grid at a northeasterly corner of it in a hospital that, typical for New York, is no longer there. It's now a high-rise condo. The hospital was shut down about 15 years or so ago. And then I spent a lot of time, I was raised in the suburbs outside of the city, went to college outside of the city, but pretty much have been back ever since, and living on and off the grid. You know, sometimes I've lived south of the grid, like way downtown. You know, the grid starts maybe your listeners are somewhat familiar. The grid starts at Houston Street, which is, you know, above the Lower East Side and things like that, and proceeds across the island to Greenwich Village, which existed before the grid was announced. And so that's where the grid starts. The grid is north of there. So you can live south of the grid in Greenwich Village or Soho or Tribeca or further downtown. And you can live above the grid, which originally was slated to end at 155th Street. That's where the grid commissioners or the street commissioners who came up with the grid in 1811, that was a northerly limit that they imposed on themselves. So I've lived all over. I've lived on the grid, off the grid. I tend to like to live, when I'm on the grid, sort of near the edge of it, so I'm not too much, you know, in its rectilinear clutches. But I've lived in the same location pretty much toward the southerly route, limits of the grid for a number of years.
So how did it occur to you, since it never occurred to any other author, to take such a thorough, close examination of something like Manhattan's grid? I mean, for whatever reason, no one ever had thought that this was worth the time. How did it occur to you that this would be an interesting story worth exploring?
Well, my interest really started a number of years ago, after 9/11, of all things. I had written a book a number of years ago on water, history of fresh water in New York, of essentially the beginnings of New York's modern water supply. And I wrote that book before I wrote the book on the Erie Canal, which you mentioned earlier. And my favorite image from the research on that book was a watercolor done in 1810 depicting the corner of Greenwich and Dey Streets, D-E-Y, in downtown Manhattan, which then was a very, very residential neighborhood of a very small, you know, two- and three-story houses. And that image showed the central portion of it. Was a woman assisting her child drawing water from a water pump at the corner. And it also showed, you know, other people on the street, but it was an amazing, almost like snapshot of New York in 1810. Well, that was the corner of Greenwich and Dey, one of my favorite images of old New York. Well, I had never seen that actual physical street corner because the original World Trade Center footprint covered it, beginning in the 1960s when the original World Trade Center was built. So that intersection went away. Well, after 9/11, the new World Trade Center footprint is actually smaller. And lo and behold, that intersection between Greenwich and Dey has reappeared. And you can actually stand at the intersection now of Greenwich and Dey, where that presumably mother was helping her child with a water pump in 1810. And that got me thinking, you know, maybe the street arrangement of Manhattan is a little more plastic than I ever imagined it to be. You know, street corners can come and go and come back again. And now that is way south. That's not anywhere near the where the grid is. But then I thought, okay, well, let's say 9/11 hadn't, and I don't want to be too morbid here, but this was sort of my thought process over the years. Let's say the target had been the Empire State Building. And, you know, the Empire State Building has been hit by a plane before. It was hit accidentally in the fog, I think, in the 1950s by an American military plane. In any case, let's say it's the Empire State Building, which is in the emotional and perhaps more importantly, physical heart of Manhattan, right smack dab in the middle of the grid. Okay, and let's say it doesn't come down on itself, but let's say it falls over on its side. This is just a speculation. And, yeah, I've actually, I have architect friends who say actually that an exercise in a number of architecture classes is the Empire State Building, you know, lays over on its side. What do you design there in the shape of the Empire State Building? So, in any case, let's say the Empire State Building, instead of coming down on itself, falls over. And now you have a central portion of the grid which has to be rebuilt. And again, I'm you know, I'm not trying to be too morbid here. Obviously, it would involve, you know, great tragedy, but it would also be a physical thing that would have to be dealt with, right? So how would you rebuild the center of Manhattan? Would you rebuild it exactly as it was in this grid, this rectilinear grid pattern that was created in 1811, when the only way that people got around was on foot or by wheeled things that were moved by humans and animals? Or would you reconstruct some of those streets that were taken out in a more modern way to move transportation the way it does now? Move transportation with the forms of surface transportation that we have now, like cars and trucks and other things. So would you build diagonals? Would you put in some circles that move traffic very nicely? Would you just put some green space, of which Manhattan has very little? So with those thoughts, I started investigating the history of the grid. And that's pretty much the genesis of the book.
We're speaking with Gerard Coppell about his newest book, which is called City on a Grid: How New York Became New York. We are talking about the grid, which is so much of Manhattan, a plan which came to sort of full completion, at least as a plan, if not constructed, in 1811. Let's take a moment to talk about the city of New York before this, actually before this three-man state commission was formed in 1807 to come up with some sort of plan for the city's future development. Taking us up to 1807, what kind of a city was New York City? How large was it? How important was it in the young nation? And what were its problems that ultimately led to the prompting of this commission to be formed?
So Manhattan, let's take a few of those questions. Importance first. Manhattan is New York is just emerging as the most important city in the country. Right around the turn of the century into the 1800s, it overtakes Philadelphia as the largest city in the country. It had earlier overtaken Boston. So New York's future is bright, mostly because of its incredibly well-protected harbor and that harbor's proximity to the ocean. So New York is emerging as an important place. It is also an incredibly disorderly place because since its founding in the early 1600s by the Dutch, its streets have come to be purely randomly. Essentially, the city, the very, very small city government through the Dutch, English, and even early American period, even though it by law has authority over the creation and maintenance of its streets, actually is very laissez-faire about it. And the city lets landowners basically put streets where on their own land, wherever they feel like putting them. And that makes for a pretty disorderly place. Very similar in some respects to Boston, also, you know, a harbor commercial city, which, by the way, has like never come up with any overarching plan like the grid plan. But New York at the time is a city of about 60,000 people, pretty much all of them living below Chambers Street. And your listeners may not be familiar with the geography, but that is essentially very downtown Manhattan. Chambers Street is where City Hall is, which was built in 1803. It is you know, generically downtown Manhattan. So you don't have most of the rest of the island is very sparsely inhabited, though not sparsely owned. Much of it is owned in vast or at least large, you know, hereditary estates, in little settlements that form, especially along the west side of the island. So the island is not really a blank slate, but is not really a heavily occupied one.
Right. So it's relatively empty, but it's not unowned. Most
Correct.
Of the land is owned by someone. And
Correct.
And at some point, some visionary people decided that as New York began to expand, as it surely was going to, it would be very, it would profit, I was going to say, and probably on us in several different ways, if there could be a stronger sort of guiding hand. One of those visionaries is a founding father who is not very well known to the typical American, someone named Gouverneur Morris. And he is such an intriguing figure, and he is a key player in the formation of this state commission to create a plan. Tell our listeners about Gouverneur Morris's role in setting some of this in motion.
Morris is really like, you know, he was a wild man, but a really smart and deeply involved one. You know, there's so many things to talk about with him. First of all, he had a peg leg, which he supposedly had after losing his leg in a hurried escape from a married woman's boudoir. It hasn't been precisely determined exactly how he got his injury. But let's just say with his peg leg, well, his peg leg was no hindrance to a lifetime of involvement with a variety of women. I'll just leave that there, and you can conjure up what I'm talking about. Very well documented, by the way, in many letters. But he's also a pretty serious guy. He was our man in Paris during the terror after the revolution. He was the only foreign minister to remain in Paris. He tried to save Louis and Marie Antoinette's heads with an escape plan. He didn't succeed in that. That really annoyed Thomas Jefferson back home, that Morris was actually trying to save the royals' heads, because Jefferson was not a big fan of royals and was a great fan of the French Revolution. A little bit later, in 1787, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Gouverneur Morris is the most active participant in the convention, and in fact, it is to him he is given the responsibility of writing the final draft of the U.S. Constitution. It's his handwriting. It's actually his physical writing is the final draft of the U.S. Constitution. And one of the things he does. Were you going to interrupt me?
No. I'm just.
Okay.
It's just extraordinary that we know so little of him.
Guy, and I'll quickly get around to the grid, but you know, he's a fascinating guy. I'll just be very quick. He personally creates the famous preamble to the Constitution. We the people of these United States. When he was given an early draft, it said, "We the people of," and it enumerated. Listed out the individual states. So more, and many people have written about this. Morris has been written about by many you know, serious American scholars. But he, in doing that, essentially draws the nation together, not as a collection of states, but as a nation of which the states are somewhat essentially a nation that is dominant over the states. And, you know, Morris was a Federalist, so you could sort of expect that of him. But in any case, that's Morris. by 1807, when he's named to the street commission to make some plan for Manhattan, he's pretty much retired. He lives on his vast estate on the mainland opposite Manhattan in what was then the county of Westchester, is now the Bronx. The Morrisania section of the Bronx, where Yankee Stadium is, some of your listeners might know, was his estate. Hmm. So in 1807, he is called upon to be essentially the leader of this three-man commission to make some kind of plan for Manhattan, because the city leaders have figured, okay, the city is growing. We need to have some kind of way forward. And the other two guys on the commission are Simon DeWitt, who is... has a 50-year career as the surveyor general of New York State. He made war maps for Washington during the Revolution. Washington wanted DeWitt to stick with him. Afterwards, DeWitt said, "Nah, I'd rather go back to Albany, where he was from." And the third guy in the commission is a guy named John Rutherford. That's U-R-D at the end, much to the chagrin of modern relatives who always see his name misspelled as O-R-D, even though the name is spelled these days on many places in New Jersey as O-R-D. John Rutherford at the time was the largest landowner in New Jersey. The only one of the three commissioners actually born on Manhattan, but spent most of his time in New Jersey. So now start imagining this picture that I've given you. Rutherford is spending most of his time in administering his lands out in New Jersey. Simon DeWitt spends most of his time in Albany figuring out how to map out New York State, turn it from essentially a frontier state into a developed state. Morris lives out on his estate in what's now the Bronx. Also, Morris has serious medical issues. He suffers from a lot of gout. He has numerous urinary tract blockages, which he details in his diaries, which I've been through. And so these are the three guys that are planning what Manhattan's going to look like. And incredibly, they are disengaged with the process. So this is what I discovered, you know, during my research. They meet fairly irregularly. There are very few letters between them. You know, there were no cell phones or other ways of communicating. They didn't really communicate for 4 years. And in 1810, 3 years into their four-year limit, because they have to come up with a plan by 1811, Morris and DeWitt are become members of the Commission on the Erie Canal. A fantastic project, you know, that transforms America, which gets going in 1810 in upstate New York. Well, all of a sudden, we see DeWitt and Morris committing extraordinary amounts of time to the beginnings of the Erie Canal Commission, writing letters back and forth to each other, spending a lot of time in upstate New York looking for a route for the Erie Canal, and at the same time, nothing about their... what they now call their Manhattan Commission. It's extraordinary. And I should note, in the 1807 law that empowers them, it says that whatever plan they come up with is the plan. Whatever they say, this is how Manhattan will develop, there can be no legal objection to it. It's a state law that empowers them.
Wow. So in other words, even if serious objections were raised or alternates suggested, that wouldn't matter. Whatever they came up with would carry the day.
And it did, because there were many lawsuits during the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s by outraged landowners that were going to have streets, you know, paved through their properties. Every time they lost. But just once back to the commission, in early 1811, in early March 1811, Morris writes a very long, detailed, highly documented report of his commission on what should be done. And that commission report is about the Erie Canal.
Mm.
3 weeks later, he issues his eight-page, not even report, but just, he called them remarks, plus the map of Manhattan. So you had intense amounts of effort by Morris and DeWitt on the Erie Canal, and almost incredibly little input about their map and how it might be implemented. And what they basically did was throw down a grid on top of Manhattan. The map ignores elevations. It ignores natural features like streams and ponds, you know, deep muddy valleys, high rocky hills. But there's the map, and okay, guys, we're out of business now. We've submitted our plan. Go for it.
The implication of what you're describing is that this was a plan that was thrown together, rushed together. Is that what you are intending to convey?
As best I can tell, they actually, and again, the records are very slim. It's mostly Morris's diary and certain of his letters and also some of DeWitt's and their chief surveyor, John Randall. Best I can tell, they actually didn't decide on what plan they were going to have until early December 1810. In other words, 4 months before they actually had to submit their plan. And I'll read you one quote from John Randall, who was their chief surveyor. Many years later, he wrote, quote, "The time within which the commissioners were limited by the statute to make their plan of the streets, avenues, and public spaces on Manhattan was barely sufficient to enable them to comply with the letter, although not fully even with the spirit of the statute."
Hmm.
Which is a fairly extraordinary statement to make.
No kidding.
And it pretty much, you know, kind of proves the point that by 1811, the commissioners, you know, put a grid on the island with no real way to implement it. And it's Randall who's then hired by the city to actually make the detailed maps showing all the natural features of the island, where the streets are, how the streets are going to intersect them, et cetera, et cetera. And that takes him 10 years.
One of the quotes that you give us from the report of Gouverneur Morris says this: whether they should confine themselves to rectilinear and rectangular streets, or whether they should adopt some of those supposed improvements by circles, ovals, and stars, which certainly embellish a plan, they could not but bear in mind that a city is to be composed principally of the habitation of men, and that straight-sided and right-angled houses are the most cheap to build and the most convenient to live in. So that gives us at least some sense of where Gouverneur Morris was coming from in terms of how this plan essentially should appear.
That is basically the founding statement about the grid. It appears in these eight pages of remarks that Morris makes. In fact, Morris didn't even author them. We presume that he wrote the remarks. In these eight pages of remarks, he refers to the commissioners by third person, and I think maybe in that quote you just read, yes, that, you know, whether they should confine themselves. So he's already sort of distancing himself even in his remarks by referring to his own commission in the third person. But yes, I mean, what he's talking about there is with this bit about circles, ovals, and stars, which certainly embellish a plan. What he's talking about there, without naming it, is Washington, D.C., which had been planned, you know, about 30 years earlier by a Frenchman. You know, by the early 1800s, our American, you know, francophilia had pretty much turned into francophobia. We had some almost gone to war with France in the early 1800s, and that's what Morris is getting at there.
Hmm.
And he's basically saying, nope, you know, it's just all, you know, right angles for us. And yet, after that short paragraph that you read, nothing more explaining why this was the right plan for Manhattan.
Hmm.
It's astounding, really.
We're speaking with Gerard Coppell about his book, City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. In this book, he examines what we now take for granted completely, that is the grid, the sort of tyrannical grid which occupies so much of Manhattan. And we're talking about the way in which that helped guide the way in which New York City ultimately took shape into the extraordinary city which it is today. So remind our listeners about some of the specifics of this grid, which this three-man commission came up with by 1811. Just how rigid and extensive was this grid?
You're basically talking 155 numbered streets from what was then called North Street, now Houston Street, up to 155th Street, and about a dozen numbered avenues, 1 through 12, they called them. The streets are all 60 feet wide, some of them randomly 100 feet wide. Again, if your listeners are familiar with Manhattan, you know that like 14th Street, 23rd Street, 34th, 42nd, 59th, these are the 100-foot wide streets. Absolutely no explanation ever for why some of those streets are 100 and why which of those streets is 100 feet wide.
Oh, so you mean like 14th and 23rd and
14th, 23rd, 34th. There's it in the lower portions, it's almost random as to which of them are 100 feet wide as opposed to the normal 60 feet wide. As you get further north, then they start counting by sixes. So you have 86, 96, 106. Then you have 110, which is also 100 feet wide. And then you start counting by fives, 125, 135, 145, 155. What was the rationale for that? Believe me, I searched for it, as many people have. I didn't find it. And there's just no explanation in any available documents. In any case, that's the streets, all parallel to each other, of course, 200 feet and 200 feet apart from each other as a general rule. And then the avenues, 12 of them, each 100 feet wide, and spaced somewhat regularly. The central portion, and that's the sort of the essential part, 3rd Avenue to 4th Avenue, 4th to 5th, and 5th to 6th, each 920 feet apart, which is a pretty big distance in a very big city. And we can talk a little bit more about that. No Central Park, that was not in the plan. Morris, if it was in fact that he that wrote their remarks, he did explain why there didn't really need to be any breaks, any substantial breaks in the grid. Here, I'll read you his quote. It may to many be a matter of surprise that so few vacant spaces have been left, and those so small. There were a few little very small parks, you know, placed in the grid. In the original grid. So few vacant spaces have been left, and those so small, for the benefit of fresh air and consequent preservation of health. Certainly, if the city of New York was destined to stand on the side of a small stream, such as the Seine or the Thames, a great number of ample places might be needful. But those large arms of the sea, which embrace Manhattan Island, render its situation in regard to health and pleasure, as well as to the convenience of commerce, peculiarly, I can never pronounce that word, felicitous. And, if you've been, to Manhattan, you realize that those large arms of the sea, especially on the east side, like the East River and the Harlem River, aren't quite so bounteous as Morris writes. The Hudson River is fairly decent size, but in any case, certainly the situation was not so felicitous as to not require Central Park to be built about 40 years later, as people realized, oh my God, we are having a overwhelming rectilinear place here with no true breathing space
at all. How quickly did this grid take shape in terms of the construction of streets, and what was the driving force there? I mean, what would prompt, in a sense, for this grid to spread yet another block and let another block? I mean, would development have to begin first, or did these streets, were they constructed and stood empty for probably a relatively brief time? But I mean, how rapid was the actual construction of the grid?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A grid is unlike, say, like a bridge. You know, you have a plan for a bridge, and even back then, in those days, you have a sense of how a bridge is going to be made and how long it's going to take to complete. Well, a grid is very amorphous. The plan developed, you know, the plan was announced in 1811. Randall took another 10 years to come up with the specific maps about how it could actually be implemented, like how to get hills out of the way and fill valleys and get rid of other natural impediments. But it takes most of the 1800s to actually complete the grid, to actually fill Manhattan with the streets that were ordained in 1811. And it pretty much happens when residents of a neighborhood, in two ways, you know, one in which residents of a neighborhood or owners of land in that area say, okay, city, we'd like our streets to be built now. In which case, the owners of that land would be assessed for some of the costs of building the street, because the street would increase the value of that land by providing access to it. They would also be compensated to some extent for the cost of their land that was lost to the physical area of the street. So there was something of a trade-off. You got a little money for losing land for the street, but you generally paid more money in assessments for the supposed benefit of making your land accessible by streets.
Early in the interview, you mentioned a painting that had caught your eye many, many years ago, with that intersection that was, in a sense, vanished for a time and then has reappeared with the new World Trade Center. You also have in this book what's really quite an extraordinary photograph, although just to glance at it, it doesn't look like anything particularly special to the casual observer. It just looks like one more slightly out of focus, black and white, nondescript photograph from early America. But in fact, it really shows us in quite a vivid way New York City in transit, in flux, from its old sensibility to this new reality of the grid. Describe that photograph to our listeners.
Now, are we talking about the paths in the dirt photograph?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So the book opens with a description of this image, and I include it. It's the lead image in the photo insert in the book. So this is taken in about 1882. From the roof of a millionaire brewer's new mansion at what was then 4th Avenue and about 94th Street. The streets had been laid, but there wasn't much habitation yet in that area, and he built this gigantic mansion up on 94th and 4th Avenue, which was not yet called or not yet renamed Park Avenue as it is today. The reason he built his mansion up there is because his brewery was a few blocks east near the river. He was German, and a lot of German brewers, in those days. In any case, the photograph looks south from his roof, and what you see on the right, sort of in the haze looking south, is the 4th Avenue with the beginnings of lot line buildings being built along the line of the avenues. And further, toward the center of the image, you see the beginnings of other buildings, multifamily dwellings, some houses, and you get a sense of how, and most of those blocks are not filled yet with buildings, but you get the sense that they're going to be. In the immediate foreground of the picture is the space between 93rd and 92nd Street, which is mostly in this photo an empty lot. Buildings are going to appear there because you get a sense from the picture that buildings are working their way north toward this place. But for the moment, this is a large empty lot, but basically half of this block is empty. And yet, in that empty lot, you can see faintly two paths. And they're essentially crisscrossing paths in the dirt that have apparently been created by people who are trying to get from one place to another. They're not going around this new-made corner, but they're moving directly as quickly as possible to get where they want to go, and that direction is in a straight line, not around a right angle. And that, to me, is really sort of the essence of the story here about how the grid, this great grid of right angles, and you know, there are many good things to say about it. I mean, the grid is incredibly powerful. It's orderly. It helped build the city. It helped give sort of a sense of rationality to the place that are essential to New York. But in those diagonals in the dirt, you also get a sense of the human interest in moving naturally, in moving to where it wants to go without having to go around right angles. And that's really kind of the theme of the book, you know, what the grid created and what was lost in the creation of the grid.
If there's anything that you say that is a bit provocative in this book, it is certainly the moment when you say that the grid favors private interest over public convenience. And actually, anybody who lives there, and even someone who loves New York City and would in a sense, not want to change it, can probably appreciate the truth of what you are saying there.
You know, I want to make clear, this is a book of history, right? I'm not a city planner. I don't really have any particular, you know, axe to grind, you know, about how the city is. This is history. And so a lot of the stuff that's in the book really comes from other people's thinking. So on that issue of private space and private versus public, I was very influenced by a quote from the Yale urban studies professor, Vincent Scully. And he said in 1969, he said, with their, what he called, implacable gridiron of limited public space, that the commissioners inaugurated, quote, the American tendency toward private luxury and public squalor.
Wow.
And, you know, I read that, and then I started thinking about it. And, you know, what happens is when everything is rectilinear, when everything is rectilinear, because Gouverneur Morris in his report said that right-sided houses are the best things for people, what that did was essentially make those places, those right-angled places, the important places, and the places outside of them less important. So if you have a diagonal boulevard, that becomes a place of public beauty and public experience. Or if you have irregular spaces, say as you do in, you know, most European cities, you know, Paris especially and London, there's more of a sense of public experience as opposed to just what's going on inside the four walls.
Hmm. It really gets us thinking about the cities in which we might live or visit, and the decisions made a long time ago that have ongoing ramifications about the way we live our lives and the way our world, in a sense, takes shape. It's a very, very interesting book. Again, City on a Grid, How New York Became New York published by Da Capo Press, and the author, Gerard Coppell. Gerard Coppell, it was great to catch up with you again. I enjoyed our previous conversation about